Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we
needed. This is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman, back with you at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show here at the Progressive Radio Network. We have been zooming to you over the past year, mostly our fantastic sessions with the Green Grassroots Emergency Election Protection Coalition. We took this week off, and that lets us thankfully talk renewable energy and nuclear power with two of the great experts. Plus, Joel Siegel is going to join us from North Carolina to talk later in the hour about election protection. Joel is the masterman of progressive legislation, the senior aide to John Conyers for many, many years. To start, we're going to talk about nuclear power and the Biden administration, nuclear, fossil fuels, and renewables with two of the great experts and activists. Tim Judson, who's out there in the middle of New Mexico next to a waste dump. As you can see, I'm in my bedroom, so what can I tell you? But this is the glories of Zoom. This is one of the only great legacies, I believe, of the pandemic will be the ongoing use of Zoom. Boy, it saves everybody a lot of trouble where you can do your radio show from your bedroom. And we have Paul Gunter, who is clearly in Tokyo with a Japanese binder behind him.
I've got home construction happening behind this blind.
Yeah, boy. You know, if your marriage survives home construction, you're a better man than most of the public. That home construction is actually the number one cause of marriages ending. As you can see, I'm on twice. I'm not getting an echo, so I'm going to leave it on twice. And you can see both my good and bad profile. Actually, they're both bad. What can I tell you? So we are in the middle, of course, of the Biden administration. Joe Biden, early in his career, he lived in Delaware across the river from two nuclear plants in New Jersey, and he hated them. And he made really derogatory comments, accurately derogatory comments, about the nuclear power industry, and especially about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And then he goes in, and the first thing he does is appoint a ridiculous hack to the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now, Tim and Paul, you know this guy very well. And he has also made some pro-nuke rumblings. He's been pro renewables in many ways, but kind of all over the map. So Tim and then Paul, you want to jump in? I think, Tim, we want to jump in with you first to at least celebrate the April 30th shutdown of the last reactor at Indian Point. You can throw your hat in the air for that one, but tell us what's going on in New York, and then give us the lowdown on the national scene, and then we'll go to Paul.
Sure. Well, you know, it's been a really historic season in New York. As you mentioned, the last reactor at Indian Point closed on April 30th, and that culminates, you know, decades of work by activists, you know, throughout New York and all over the country that have been fighting to close Indian Point almost since it opened back in the early 60s. You know, the interesting thing about the closure of Indian Point, and this is why NIRS co-founded with a number of other groups a project called Beyond Indian Point, is that, you know, the nuclear industry and its, you know, sort of cadre of front groups and, you know, and sort of nuclear enthusiasts, as I like to call them, have really sort of used the closure of Indian Point to try to create a really divisive moment around what it means for the future of energy and climate in this country. You know, we've really seen a proliferation of, you know, of front groups and agitators that are trying to spin the message that the closure of nuclear power plants is, you know, is a disaster for climate and, you know, and is going to lead to more fossil fuel consumption. You know, despite all the evidence to the contrary of what's happening in New York and in other states where nukes are closing. But this is really feeding into what's happening in this sort of the national, you know, energy and policy debate is around what's going to happen with nuclear power, you know, as the, you know, as the nation takes climate change more seriously.
Well, yeah, I mean, the New York Times ran a bunch of pieces saying how global warming is going to get worse because nuclear power is shut down. What I want to know is, because of Indian Point shutting down, what I want to know is, how do people think that a radioactive fire burning at 570 degrees Fahrenheit helps cool the earth? I mean, I'm still trying to figure that one out. Paul Gunter, do you have an answer to that question?
Well, you know, I think the big concern with the Biden administration is that they are going, you know, the fact that they're still dallying with nuclear power is going to retard the move towards renewables at a rate that we can actually abate climate change. And, you know, it's clear that, you know, the studies are out there now that if even, you know, Biden's talking about, you know, $20 billion from the infrastructure bill to go towards keeping uneconomical, aging, increasingly dangerous nuclear power plants running when otherwise they would shut down. And that is, you know, what that creates is this diversion of resources going into renewables, where that's where the market drive is right now. And that, you know, we should be developing a Manhattan 2 project now to get off of nuclear, power and weapons, and go with the renewables and efficiency and conservation. But he's going to keep 1 foot in the tar pit, and that's going to, you know, it's clear what's going to happen. It's going to draw our economy backwards. And when we should be moving post haste into a 21st century energy policy.
Well, that's 100% right. I mean, it's ridiculous. I have to say, the other innovation for me from the COVID is the watching of tons and tons of documentaries on Netflix and others. I have seen the, and I recommend everybody I see when we talk about nuclear to watch the, I think it was ABC or Hulu series on Chernobyl. And I have to say that having watched movies and TV series all my life, I have never seen anything more terrifying. I think it's a 5-part series. I made the mistake of watching it over three nights, and I couldn't sleep. I'm very rarely affected by stuff like that. But anyone listening, all you listeners out there, if you really want to understand nuclear power, you have to see the series on Chernobyl. And my recommendation is that you watch it all at once. That you get up in the morning, maybe on a weekend, start maybe 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, and just watch it straight through. Because if you watch it over a series of 3, 4, 5 nights, you're going to not sleep. And this is actually the best way to watch it, as far as I'm concerned. I did watch the other day something that also terrified me about nuclear power, and it wasn't about nuclear power at all. It was about the Challenger, the shuttle that blew up. And that one is, I don't know, four or five hours, I believe. And a lot of it is about the astronauts and, of course, that they died. But the reality is that they knew, Morton Thiokol knew. There were guys at Morton Thiokol who were sobbing and calling in and saying, this thing is going to blow up. And they knew exactly why it was going to blow up. And it exactly blew up exactly the way they said it would blow up. And if you really, you don't have to watch the whole thing. You just watch the last episode of the last flight of the Challenger on Netflix. It completely translates to nuclear power, because we know that nuclear power, I mean, we can sit here and list how these reactors are going to blow up. And, you know, every day they get older. I believe every reactor in the United States now, except for Watts Bar, is 40 years or older. Is that right? Are there any reactors less than 40 years old?
It's about half the reactors in the country are over 40, and about the other half are between 30 and 40.
Right. No, nobody's Watts older
Bar,
than 40.
Watts Bar came on in 96.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, more than 20 years already. Yeah. But you know that's spring chicken. And then you got the two at Vodal. I mean, what are the odds those two are going to actually open? They've been under construction for what, 12, 15 years now? They're $70 billion.
They originally announced the project in 2008 and they got their license in 2013. And so they've been under construction now for close to 8 years. And, you know, the reality, you know, the announcements just keep on coming in. They were, you know, for the last couple of years, Southern Company has been, keeping a very firm line on its commitment that it was going to have the first reactor online in November of this year and the second one November of next year. But in the last couple of months, they've already announced that they're going to miss those targets twice. Unit one is not going to come online. It'll probably spring of next year. And they're not saying anything about unit two, it's unit four, unit three and unit four. It's just a matter. I mean, it's all now that they're actually in the latter stages of construction, they're starting to do some of the testing that's necessary in order for them to get approval to start the reactor. Now they're discovering all of these problems that have cropped up in the construction that are delaying their ability to complete all the tests they need to do. So who knows what's going to happen over the next 6 months about what they discovered is that a lot of their contractors, especially the electrical contractors, in order to meet the deadlines that they had on the project, were basically not doing the job properly, and they're finding all sorts of errors in how the wiring was done.
Yeah, you can hear the refrain in the background to this project, Paul Simon's "The closer to your destination, the more you keep slip sliding away."
maybe they should call one of the reactors "Slip" and the other one "Sliding." Joel Siegel in North Carolina, do you want to jump in on anything having to do with energy here?
Yes. Honored to be on your show, Harvey. It's very clear that we need to go to 100% clean renewable energy, 80% in the next 10 years, according to the great climate scientist Lester Brown. Lester Brown has said over and over again in all of his books that per kilowatt nuclear power is unbelievably expensive. It's not even close to solar or wind, so economically it makes no sense to have nuclear power. It takes a long time to get these plants online. Number two, how many more nuclear power plants have to blow up for people to understand, you know, we're literally dealing with fire, whether it's, you know, Chernobyl, Fukushima, and what can, as we move forward on climate change legislation, is that there will be both Democrats and Republicans advocating for the use of nuclear power without having enough information about clean, renewable energy. So we as progressives are going to have to do our job educating about why we should go solar and wind or geothermal and not nuclear. And then if people don't listen, we're going to have to go back to the days of what I used to do when I was in my early 20s, late teens. Because of people like you, Harvey, when I was at UNC Chapel Hill in college, we protested against the building of nuclear power plants, and we won. And it's really frightening to think that, you know, people are going to be using a technology which on every level makes absolutely no sense. I don't understand.
Well, Joel, that's 100% on target. You've got a problem there with your phone. I don't know if you can join us on Zoom or...
Oh, is it better?
I got some static with that. So if you can possibly join us on Zoom, that would be great.
Yeah, I'll do that. I just need to be let in. If the engineer could just let me in, that'd be great. I couldn't get in.
Okay. All right. Okay. Matt, if you can let Joel into the Zoom call, that'd be great. Okay. And by the way... Joel and I are working, we're going to talk about this in the second hour. Joel and I have been working on many things having to do with election protection, and we are planning a major event at the end of August, August 27th to 9th, in Washington, D.C. Paul, it's in your neighborhood. A national dream event. It's the anniversary of the Dr. King speech on the Lincoln Memorial. It's the Dream March for D.C. Statehood. Green jobs and justice. However, we've run into a glitch because we've been planning this for August 27th, 8th, and 9th, and now Donald Trump has announced that he's going to be re-inaugurated and become president again in August. So we may have to move the date around because, of course, Donald Trump is going to have at least 30 or 40 people at his second inauguration there, like he did at the first one. So we'll have to be careful of that. Joey, you made it on. Good to see you, bro.
Good to see you.
All right. Hey, you did everything. All right. Good. So here's the question. Is Biden really going to put another $20 billion into operating reactors? And where's the money going to go? I mean, Tim, what's the deal on this latest bailout situation?
Yeah, well, this is it's a complicated situation, and I think this is going to be a moving target for at least the next couple of months. And let me explain why, because I think it's going to be really important for people to kind of have a better understanding of what's happening in Washington. That's resulting in all of this. So President Biden, back in March, introduced his, big $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan, the American Jobs Plan. And so this is his major initiative to revive the economy, through rebuilding our infrastructure, through, and part of that is going to be what he wants to include is a renewable energy standard or clean energy standard, to get to 100% clean energy by 2035, which is an incredibly, which is a really aggressive target. It's very much in line with what, the more ambitious end of the climate movement is wanting to happen. But the way that they're going to have to do this, because the Senate majority is so slim, and there's virtually no way that they could get 60 votes to pass legislation through the Senate, is through a legislative process that's called reconciliation. And this is really wonky, but basically what it is it's a legislative, it's a legislative measure to basically amend the budget that's already been approved. And that they can do with a simple majority of 51 votes, with the vice president carrying the last vote. The trouble is that in reconciliation, you can only basically amend the budget. You can't change policy through this reconciliation process. And the Democrats are very concerned that as we're getting closer to the 2022 election, that anything major they're going to do, they've got to get done before August of this year. And so there's a huge press on to get this entire huge $2.3 trillion infrastructure package done through a budgeting process in the next 2 to 3 months, which is obviously compressed everything in Washington to a complete and total scrum. And so there's negotiations happening between the White House and Congress, between the White House and Congress and the activist communities and the advocacy organizations, with all of the corporate America lobbying like crazy throughout this entire process, all of course still during COVID, where everything is still happening on Zoom. So what we expect to happen is that there's bills that are already been introduced in Congress that they're planning on trying to put into this bigger piece of legislation that's going to be Biden's infrastructure plan. So there's sort of proxy sort of legislation happening now, where, for instance, Senator Wyden has a bill that would create a big tax credit for mostly renewable energy. That would be sort of the backbone of this clean energy standard. Now, what happened a few weeks ago is that the White House sent a message to Congress saying that it wanted to include a subsidy to make sure that nuclear reactors didn't close before they could be replaced with renewable energy. So that signaled that what the White House was proposing was to include existing reactors in this big subsidy that Wyden was proposing. That would be $200 billion over 10 years, which is phenomenal. And we pushed back immediately on that. What happened then last week, there was a group of senators who introduced an amendment to Wyden's bill to do the same thing. But that would cost a bit less than what we were concerned was going to happen based on what the White House said. So based on what they introduced as an amendment to this bill last week, it would be $50 to $100 billion over 10 years to subsidize aging uneconomical reactors to keep them running for the next decade.
Well, let me get this straight. They want to keep the reactors open until they can be replaced with renewables. Why don't they just spend the money on renewables?
That's obviously the right. That's obviously the right question. And in fact, what's also kind of crazy about this is that Biden's budget for this jobs plan is $2.3 trillion. He doesn't want to increase that because he's paying for it. You know, he has to pay for it by raising taxes, and so he wants to only raise taxes on corporations.
Right.
And so he's limited in but he's limited himself in terms of how much this plan can cost in order to pay for it through taxing corporations. So if you're gonna take a whole huge chunk of money that's supposed to be for this 100% clean energy standard and give it to old nukes instead of the renewables, then they're sacrificing tens of thousands of jobs right off the top from this American jobs plan. So, I mean, in certain sense, it's a question of like, so which tens of thousands of people's jobs are you going to give away to, in order to just subsidize these old nuclear power plants?
But the big concern is that, renewables are going to reduce more carbon cheaper. So pouring more money down this nuclear rat hole puts you in the most inefficient process for addressing climate change.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, these people just won't give up on this technology. I mean, you've got small reactors, you got thorium reactors, you got fusion reactors. And then you got these old light water reactors. None of them work. None of them can compete with renewables. The jump ahead on renewables is astounding, and they're still fooling around with these old nukes. I mean, I don't get it.
Well, I mean, honestly, Harvey, I think obviously we're right. None of this really makes any sense. It's all about it's all about bailing out the nuclear industry so that they'll hopefully support what Biden wants to do. But the reality is, all along, we've seen it with the state bailouts the last several years. We've seen it happen for decades, going back to the 70s. Every time, whether it's a state government or a federal government makes an investment in nuclear power, it comes at the expense of renewable energy and clean energy. So I actually think that we can win this fight. And this is when, I don't want to be, overly Pollyanna-ish here, but I actually think that we have an opportunity, to win this argument in the next 2 to 3 months. We're going to have to fight like hell to do it, because like I said, the nuclear industry's lobby army of lobbyists is relentlessly pounding Capitol Hill with the message that you can't meet the climate goals without nuclear power. But I actually think that the weight of both moral suasion, because of the horrendous environmental justice impacts with nuclear power, as well as the clearly counterproductive effect this would have on reducing emissions and building renewable energy, it's all on our side. And I think especially with the way that this is going to compromise the revival of the economy and creation of jobs, we can actually win this fight. And if we do that, if we win this fight in the next 2 to 3 months, then that means we're going to potentially have a national policy to get to 100% clean energy by 2035 that doesn't include any support for nuclear power.
Then the question becomes, how can we shut these reactors before the next one blows up? Joel Siegel?
I really like what Tim said. So I worked in Congress from 2000 to 2013, was the lead staffer and author of the bill Medicare for All. And for 13 years, I saw how a bill gets passed or how a bill gets killed. And the one thing that both have in common, and Congressman Conyers used to say it all the time, you got to have what's called critical mass. That means members of Congress have to get flooded with calls from the local offices to the national office. They got to look at MSNBC or CNN and hear those who oppose the kind of policies of the right wing. My question I have and comment would be, how are we going to organize ourselves to the point where we have way more power, political on the ground power, than the nuclear industry. And that is the conversation that we must have if we're going to win the battle of climate change. And then not only in America, but internationally. And I'll close by saying this is the first time in my life where how we organize will determine whether or not we survive as human beings. There is an issue that I have with the nonprofit NGO world, and that's TERF. And I see Tim shaking his head. TERF, what I call the Foundation Grant Industrial Complex, because you can have an ally that should be your ally, but it doesn't mean they're really your ally if they won't answer your phone call and meet with you in a room. And we're going to have a much more multiracial movement for clean energy, and it's going to have to be way more intersectional, because everyone who wants to survive, you know, a nuclear blast or climate change, whether you're for Medicare for All or ending homelessness or ending poverty or fight for 15, have got to see the relationships between their fight and the fight that we're talking about. 100%.
Absolutely. Well, Paul Gunter, do you want to jump in on that?
I completely agree with Joel and Tim. I hesitate to say this, but I think it's necessary, because just as this has to be, it has to be a diverse movement. It's imperative that it also include the youth movements, like the Sunrise movement. And I'll just tell you, what we're seeing right now is, while Sunrise is coming out against new reactors, they're starting to buy into this, to bail out the old ones. And that's a tragedy. We'd like to see more teach-ins particularly with the youth, but also, with all diversity. We need to bring in experts can show that if you spend more money on aging, deteriorating nuclear power stations, you begin to slide away from your climate goals. And it's inevitable. It's like, watching Lucy offer Charlie Brown the football again and again, and each time we know what's going to happen. And now we're concerned the Sunrise movement's going to wind up flat on its back. So, I mean, this is a dialogue that we need to have. And I think that we just need to get it out there and start this discussion.
Well, the critical issue is how dangerous these old reactors are. I mean, who is driving a 35-year-old car that was built by the lowest bidders? I mean, come on. These things are insane.
But, more so, Harvey, it's a dilapidated jalopy at 65 in a snowstorm. They're overdriving their lights right now. They don't know the future of material degradation. And they're the savings that they're achieving right now are not looking at how cracks initiate, how quick cracks grow to failure, how embrittlement is advancing. They don't want to know this. And so they're extending operating licenses now. Practically all of the nation's 93 reactors are operating within a 20-year extension now, from 40 to 60. Some are going 60 to 80, and they're talking about 80 to 100.
It's insane.
Without knowing how these things are deteriorating at a material level.
Well, I mean, 2 years ago, it's 2 years already, I got a petition in California signed by 2,500 people to go to Gavin Newsom, the great liberal. And all we asked them to do was inspect Diablo Canyon. Just see how badly embrittled it is. And he just completely blew us off. they still haven't looked, you know, to see how embrittled Unit 1 is. And we know Unit 1 at Diablo is severely embrittled. It's been embrittled since, they know, since 15 years ago, for God's sakes. And that means if it's embrittled, it has no brakes. If you got to pour water into a superheated reactor and the core is embrittled, the pressure vessel and the piping is embrittled, it's going to blow up. And, it's terrifying, absolutely terrifying to me. Here's the other question, politically. When is the renewable energy industry going to have as much money to spend on lobbyists as the nuclear industry? Now, we're seeing all over the country that there are anti-solar bills. There's one in the California legislature right now, desperately designed to slow down the spread of solar panels, for God's sake.
I mean, honestly, Harvey, I don't think we can wait for that, and I don't think we can pretend that, you know, that another set of corporations, i.e. renewable energy corporations, are going to necessarily, you know, be the force for change that, you know, that the environmental and environmental justice movements are. And I'll tell you, and, you know, and also don't think we can wait for a day when they're going to have the same amount of political clout as the nuclear industry, because the reality is that the nuclear industry isn't just a bunch of companies that run nuclear power plants. They're also the biggest utility companies in the country. And so they have billions and billions and billions of dollars in access to ratepayers and access to politicians and decades of having lobbied and given, you know, bought politicians that the renewable energy industry is just not going to have in the next decade. And so I really think that, like, you know, that we need to do all we can to make sure that the renewable energy builds up as fast as possible. But I honestly think that, you know, that we also have a lot more friends. You know, the anti-nuclear movement has a lot more friends than we think we do. And I'll tell you why is that, you know, over the last several years, you know, NIRS has gotten much more involved in the climate movement writ large. You know, we've been a member of the U.S. Climate Action Network, which is the largest network of climate groups in the country with over 180 members. We've been building those relationships for the last several years. And what we found is actually the majority of groups in the climate movement are anti-nuclear. They work on other issues, and, you know, and as we've experienced, I think, as you know, for a very long time, there's not been enough of an investment, you know, from the foundation industrial complex that Joel was talking about in anti-nuclear issues, to build the capacity of groups to work on nuclear powers as much as on climate or other issues. But the reality is that the mainstream opinion within the climate movement is that nuclear power has to go as well. It's just that, you know, that most of those groups don't have it's not part of their regular work to work on it. But so what we've been able to do is to build alliances around the intersectional approaches that Joel was talking about, with groups that are also fighting biomass, the groups that are also fighting, you know, fracking and carbon capture and sequestration and other dirty energy sources that are also going to be part of this infrastructure plan that we need to be working with to make sure that what actually gets enacted in, you know, within the next 2 to 3 months is 100% renewable energy, not a clean energy standard that includes a bunch of false solutions like nuclear and biomass and carbon capture.
Right. And, you know, we do wherever Biden comes down, we do know he knows the issue. But we still have a nuclear regulator. There's not even any single guy person that's good on the NRC now, is there? Paul Gunter, you work at the NRC all the time. Is there anybody, even one of the five commissioners, that we can talk to?
Well, if I was to tell you, it'd be the kiss of death for that person.
Oh, okay. All right.
No, but I think that, you know, generally you can look at the voting record and you can tell that Commissioner Jeff Barron is the one that's holding closest to the NRC's mandate to prioritize public health and safety first. And that's true. Biden passed him over for commission chair, however. And when he came in, put in Chris Hansen, who is essentially, before he came, Well, he worked as deputy director of the Department of Energy's nuclear division. So he's like a nuke salesman that stepped in to the job. And you know, I'm not gonna malign his credibility or integrity, but you know, from salesman to safety advocate is a stretch. It's a dangerous stretch.
Yeah, right.
And
you know, part of the problem is also, I mean, the problem isn't just who's appointed to the commission. I mean, as we saw, you know, more than 10 years ago now, President Obama appointed, you know, Greg Diaczko as the chair of the commission. And, you know, he served as, you know, as a fairly independent voice on the commission, you know, who made some good decisions and voted the right way on a number of things, including, you know, not approving the licenses to build the Vogtle 3 and 4 reactors before they you know, completed making their post-Fukushima upgrades to the reactor's design. But what happened was, is that there was essentially, you know, a high level initiative within the NRC that starting with the staff actually to kick him out as the chairman of the commission, and Congress supported that. And so part of the problem is not just, you know, who gets appointed to the commission, but what's their mandate when they get appointed. And the reality the Congress for the last, you know, I mean, Congress has always been pro-nuclear in general. But especially in the last 10 to 15 years, has consistently been pushing the NRC to lighten its regulation of the industry, to push the NRC to reduce the regulatory burden on the industry. And so all the things that we're complaining about in terms of nuclear safety, part of that is because Congress is sending the message to the NRC to back off on regulation. So if we're going to get an NRC that's going to regulate more responsibly to its mission and to what's needed with an aging fleet of reactors in the midst of climate change, you know, where the threats of natural disasters are increasing at the time as safety margins are being reduced, there's got to be a different mandate from Congress to the NRC to how to do its job. And so one of the things that we see consistently is that, you know, you have, you know, Democrats in Congress, like some, for instance, you know, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and Senator Cory Booker, who keep on staking their support for nuclear power on it being safely regulated at the same time as they're sending the message to the NRC to back off on regulation. So I think
this is happening at precisely the time that every day the nuclear reactors get more dangerous. Every day they get older and more embrittled and more cracked and more screwed up. And all these reactors are pre-digital. They're all designed on slide rules, for God's sakes. Except for, you know, Vogtle. And so while they get older and more dangerous and more decrepit, they're getting less regulated. It's terrifying.
It's true. Well, and the interesting thing is that, you know, last year, this very interesting thing happened around this time last year is the House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis released its report on what the congressional policy agenda for climate change and climate justice should be. And in that document, they actually listened to a lot of the activist community. They consulted with a lot of climate justice groups. They reviewed a lot of the recommendations that were coming out of the climate justice movement about what the climate policy should be. And so in this document, number one, they really emphasize that environmental justice has to be a key priority for this country and how we deal with climate change. Schizophrenically, they also said that nuclear power, you know, is going to need to be a part of that. But in all of their recommendations, they said both environmental justice has to be, there needs to be better practices for environmental justice in the nuclear industry, and that the nuclear safety needs to be regulated more strongly. That was in the House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis's report. And so there actually is a mandate, at least within the House, for there to be stronger regulation of nuclear power in this country going forward. And that's something I think we need to really hammer away on.
But at the foundation of this, we understand NRC to mean nuclear regulatory capture. And that begins with the fact that the nuclear power industry provides 90% of the NRC budget through licensing fees of this exactly aging nuclear industry.
Yeah. And so one of the ways they control the NRC.
We've got a contradiction built in to the oversight process where, you know, after Fukushima, all of the GE Mark I boiling water reactors should have been shut down, at least to have a thorough inspection. But, you know, that was 33 reactors of a, 98 reactor force. They would have had to shut down more than a third of their industry, which means the way that Congress has set up the budgeting process. I mean, Congress makes the appropriations, but then NRC has to collect it from licensing fees. But the way it's set up, NRC, their hands are tied behind their back if they needed to actually do something about, the failure that we had demonstrated at Fukushima.
It's truly, truly astounding. And on the flip side, of course, is the astonishing continued, doesn't seem to stop, improvements in renewable energy. And I gotta point out one moment. In 1975, before any of you guys were born, there was a giant conference at UMass in Amherst, the Toward Tomorrow Fair. And the two main principal people there in renewables were Amy Lovins and William Hieronymus, who was a pioneer in wind energy. And William Hieronymus had these drawings of offshore wind turbines that were going to be 5 megawatts, which was incomprehensibly huge at the time. And they were not anchored. They were not, the poles were not driven into the ocean floor. They were on tethers, on chains, and with a giant ball for anchoring the thing or for keeping it from spinning around. And everybody laughed at him. They said, turbines, offshore turbines, are not going to get to 5 megawatts. The ones at Altamont Pass were 50 kilowatts, for God's sakes. 5 megawatts is what, 100 times bigger. And today, right now, General Electric has introduced and is building offshore windmills, offshore wind turbines that are 13 megawatts. They are two-thirds the height of the Empire State Building, and they will sit in the ocean without poles into the bottom, but anchored on chains with the giant ball, just like Hieronymus said, 46 years ago.
And those are floating.
They're floating.
And they're out 18 to 50 miles offshore.
Right. And,
the wind is constant out there.
Right, and strong. And so you don't have to buy right away because you put the cables underwater and they come in. And in fact, they finally found a good use for the Diablo Canyon site. They're going to be able to funnel in the power from the offshore windmills to the grid at Diablo Canyon so that they'll be able to use the switching stations at Diablo to redistribute the power coming in from offshore. And I got to say that there's quite a bit of understanding that these offshore wind farms will create a lot of jobs. Right. The other thing I heard, and by the way, this is tangential, and then we'll get to Joel and the election issues, but the idea of these offshore windmills, the fishing industry has been complaining about the offshore wind is going to harm the fishing industry. So I don't know how many of you guys and my listeners, but I highly recommend there's a movie on Netflix called, a documentary called Seaspiracy, Seaspiracy, which really hammers the fishing industry. Mm. And the theory now is that in order to preserve our fish stocks, which are obviously being completely decimated, what you need to do is to make about one third of the world's oceans into no fish zones. And what they found is that in no fishing zones, if you don't mess with the fish at all, and you leave the ecosystem intact, one third of the oceans will have spillover sufficient to keep the rest of the fishing industry going. So what we can do is where there are offshore windmills, we can just make those no fishing zones, and we can preserve the world's fish stocks. Just one of those little details. Tim and Paul, Paul, we'll start with you. Is there anything further you want to say? What's happening at Seabrook, Paul? Any idea of getting that place shut?
Well, you know, the bad news is that Seabrook has concrete cancer, alkali silica reaction that is the concrete containment structure and the spent fuel pool has irreversibly lost 30% of the concrete's compression strength.
Jesus.
In you know, less than 40 years. And they've been given us 40 to 60 license extension. So the fight is on, you know, to have greater oversight of the Seabrook concrete cancer issue. And but again, these kinds of material diseases of this dangerous industry are popping up all over, in all kinds of materials, not just concrete, not just embrittlement of reactor pressure vessels, but electrical cable. 600 miles of electrical cable in your typical nuclear power station, much of which doesn't get inspected because it's not accessible for inspection. So we're flying blind on a lot of this. That's the concern.
Terrifying, absolutely terrifying. And I got to say, there's three reactors in New Jersey. Are they all embrittled?
Every one of the reactor, you know, the neutron bombardment of the reactor core is causing this embrittlement.
So every reactor in the country is subject to embrittlement.
It is a constant state of degradation.
Unbelievable. Tim Judson?
Yeah, just, you know, something for people to chew on as we're thinking about how to fight this national nuclear bailout. You know, a couple months ago, the largest nuclear corporation in America, the Exelon Corporation, which runs 23 reactors in 5 states and has been, you know, pushing for the bailouts at the state level, you know, for the last several years. Exelon announced about 3 months ago that it wants out of the nuclear business. It is trying to spin off its entire nuclear business, as well as you know, its very, very small renewable energy business, into an entirely separate new corporation that would be publicly traded. And so, you know, if the largest nuclear corporation in America, which can't find another company to buy its uneconomical nuclear plants, because if Exelon can't run them profitably, no one can. If that corporation doesn't see a future in nuclear power, then why should anyone else?
Well, Joel Siegel, you have a group called JAMIN, which is deals with political and ecological issues. Why don't we get NIRS and Beyond Nuclear and JAMIN to purchase all these old reactors for a dollar and then declare bankruptcy? That would do the job, right, Joel?
You can count me in. JAMIN was formed by leading environmental, climate change, anti-poverty activists who realized that we would be stronger together than separately. So we had two national conferences, one in DC, one in NYU. And the reason why I'm so glad, we had Bill McKibben, by the way, and Lester Brown and Jeffrey Sachs were the keynote speakers, and Representative from Maryland. The reason why that was such an important meeting at NYU is because we're connected. So all these different activists of all different colors, backgrounds, we got to know each other. And once JAMIN gets properly funded and we can have our third conference, I feel like this might be a network that could absolutely save the planet one day, because, you know, we had music and dance, and it was at the Tisch School of the Arts. But we're going to have another major national conference of all the different activists who work on climate change and green jobs. We have to bring in people from other countries. If we do not really, you know, get to the point where we have real power, it's going to be tough. One thing about Congress, the one thing that was interesting when I worked there, I wrote several bills on climate change and green energy. The first question that I used to get from the staffers, well, by the way, Representative Jamie Raskin, they would say, well, if we transition to 100% clean, renewable energy, what about all the jobs from the coal and, you know, and oil? They were not concerned about the climate change at all. They cared about the jobs, but we're going to have to make sure that as a movement, we answer that question immediately. And that's that they have to have a soft landing. These workers, they got to get paid salaries, benefits, or we're not going to pass too much legislation in Congress. That has to be a good talking point.
I'm thrilled, and we're going to have to sign off here. I'm thrilled to have connected Joel Siegel with Tim Judson and Paul Gunter. What we should do on August 27th, 8th, and 9th, the green jobs portion of this march for voter rights and D.C. statehood, we need to get together and have that meeting. It'll be right after Trump's second inauguration, so we'll be in tune there. But Tim, I'm thrilled to have connected you and Paul with Joel. We will make this happen at the end of August. We got to do two things. We got to make sure the public understands how dangerous these old reactors are. I have never been more terrified by nuclear power than I am. Every successive day, I wake up and just hope I'm not reading about the next meltdown. And we have to emphasize that the jobs are in renewables. And that's where it's at. Listen, you guys, thank you so very much. I wish we had more time. This just flew by, as it always does. Joel and I have a piece up, Solving the Middle East Crisis. It's at Reader Supported News. You may want to support rsn.org. It's the Lysistrata method. Need I say more? It's always great to see you guys. We will jam together August 27th-9 in D.C. Thank you, Matt and Jesse at Progressive Radio Network. And we will see you again next week in Solartopia.